Okay, so as you can see, I'm a statistician, not a physicist. I became interested in these sort of issues because I'm interested in the foundations of probability and statistics, and there are various puzzling things, the first of which was the notorious doomsday argument, which I'm not going to get into here, that led me to look at the sort of questions that arise in these sorts of cosmological contexts. So I'm going to talk about probability and about anthropic reasoning in small, large, and infinite universes. And so maybe I should say what those mean. Small universes are ones in which it's unlikely that there's some duplicate of you somewhere else in the universe with exactly the same memories as you have. And large is bigger than that, and then infinite is even bigger than that. So I'm going to start here by talking a bit about probability. Look at some consequences of the standard view of probability to working in infinite universes. First of all, probability, can I point at things? Yes. Not very easily, maybe I won't try to. Probability is defined for what we call events that are just subsets of some larger space. And we might define those events in terms of what we call random variables by things like x equals 0 is the event that x ends up with the value 0, or y might be in some interval. And we define conditional probabilities, probability B given A, as the probability that both A and B happen, or are true, or whatever, divided by the probability that B happens. Now, the an important thing to keep in mind is that this is a mathematical theory in which the interpretation of what a probability actually means is not a part of the mathematics. So there are various interpretations that are put forward, such as the frequentist frequency interpretation there of limits of frequencies, or the other main interpretation is a degree of belief interpretation in which they represent how strongly you believe something is true, and that's an interpretation often used in everyday life. And you can get into other interpretations or variations on those as well, but the mathematical theory, of course, doesn't have anything to do with that. The mathematical theory just is a consequence of certain axioms, which I list out there. The first two are very simple. Probabilities are non-negative, and the probability of anything happening is just one. And then we have the third axiom, which is much more complicated. Says that if we have some countable sequence of events that are all pairwise disjoint, then the probability for the union of those events is just the sum of the probabilities. And this is called the countable additivity axiom. And sometimes people have thought this is a little bit restrictive, and they've define probabilities that don't obey that axiom, but just obey the weaker axiom that's true for a finite collection of A1 up to AK, not for a countably infinite collection. And that's mathematically possible to do that, but you get some rather paradoxical results from that. And it seemed worthwhile to me to start by saying a bit about that, because it seems like it may be relevant in this sort of cosmological context you're looking at here, although I don't have a specific thing saying, oh, such and such paper, it's all wrong because it didn't satisfy countable additivity. It's quite common for people to do things like have been discussed here, of taking limits of probabilities that do satisfy countable additivity, and then so that each along the way countable additivity is satisfied, and that, but then in the limit it's not satisfied, and nevertheless manage to get some sort of reasonable result out. But there are at other times funny things can happen. So I'll give one example of that. Need chalk. Suppose our whole space that our events are subsets of is the set of pairs of natural numbers. So I and j are natural numbers from 1 on up. And we decide to define some probability distributions over this set by saying that there's some limit here. So we have here, of course, a grid of points here. And so here we have 1, 1, and so forth. And we put some limit here. And we say that the probability for a particular pair ij is 1 over n squared if I and j are less than or equal to n, and 0 otherwise. So we just have a uniform distribution over this square that goes out to distance n. And that's the nth probability distribution that we have. And then we talk about some probabilities for some event that are the limits of those as n goes to infinity. So this is, so we're just moving our cutoff here out to infinity and seeing what we get for probabilities. And of course, one thing that happens is the probability of any particular point goes to 0, because as n goes to infinity, it goes to 0. That's not, presumably we're not disturbed by that. But let's consider a set A. That's the set of all pairs ij such that I is less than or equal to j. Okay, so that's the set. That's the set up here, right? The set A is just the part above the diagonal, including the diagonal, but the diagonal will be negligible asymptotically. And now we could ask what the probability of that is. Well, it's a. You can see that in that limit, the probability of A is going to be a half. So that's probably about what you expected. But now let's look at some conditional probabilities. We can ask, what's the probability of the set A conditional on I having a particular value? Here, I is equal to 3. Okay, so that's the probability of A given the event of it's the set of all pairs 3j. So we've conditioned on I being 3, but we let j be anything here. And we ask, what's the conditional probability of A given that? So as we take the limit of getting our cutoff go further and further out, that conditional probability is going to be 1. Right? So for any finite cutoff, it's something that's not 1. But as we put our cutoff further and further out, we've only got 2 points here below the diagonal, and we get more and more of them above the diagonal, and they're sort of all equally likely. And so we end up with that conditional probability being 1. And that's true. If we change from 3 to arbitrary I, that's true for all I, right? All the conditional probabilities given any value for I are equal to 1. But the overall probability of A is a half. So this is a violation of what's called conglomerability, which says that if you partition your space into some events that partition the space, and look at the conditional probability for some other event given each of those, that the unconditional probability ought to be somewhere in the range of those. Right. Conglomerability, or non-conglomerability. So that's violated here. I mean, all these conditional probabilities are 1. Normally, you can get the unconditional probability by averaging the conditional probabilities over the distribution of I in this case. And of course, when you do that average, you get a result that's somewhere within the range of the conditional probabilities, but not here. And furthermore, if you work out here, the opposite one, we say, well, now let's fix J and ask what's the conditional probability of A given J in the limit as we take our cutoff out to infinity? Well, it's zero, right? As you take the cutoff out to infinity, we have only J plus one points in A, and we get more and more points not in A. So this conditional probability is zero for all J, again showing that it doesn't satisfy conglomerability. And furthermore, well, it sort of is even more strange, perhaps. So this is the sort of strange thing that can happen when you're taking these limits and the final probabilities, so to speak, do not satisfy the countable additivity axiom. And so that's a possible thing that can happen. You can see that discussed by Seidenfeld, Shervis, and Kadane in a paper there. If I recall correctly, they're actually not disturbed by this. They sort of like finitely additive probabilities. Like this isn't a mathematical inconsistency. It's only inconsistent with your idea that conglomerability ought to hold. Personally, all their results convince me that you don't want them, or at least you'd want to avoid the bad consequences, but they happen to like them. But that doesn't affect the mathematics. Another example of the sort of thing that can go wrong when you sort of do limits with cutoffs, in which the limit can have properties that are much different than any point along the way, is the shooting room paradox, which I won't actually describe here in the interests of time, but you can read about. So that's a little bit about the axioms of probability and how they might be relevant to the sort of things you're doing. As I say, I don't actually have any example about saying, oh, somebody's doing this cutoff procedure and it's all sort of doing something strange because of this sort of phenomenon, but it seems like something one might want to pay attention to. So now I'm going to get to something that's more central to what I'm talking about, which is how one should use probability to do inference, sort of scientific inference in particular. This is, I'm going to base this on what's called the Bayesian approach to statistics, which, of course, is not the only approach people, statisticians, take to statistics. But without arguing about the philosophical foundations of statistics at the moment, we can the Bayesian inference approach is that you use probability for all aspects of inference. And to do that, you have to interpret your probabilities as degrees of belief. So you don't always interpret them as long-range relative frequencies. Sometimes you interpret them that way because, of course, if the long-range relative frequencies of something converge to a half, then the rational thing to do is to believe that it happens, have a half degree of belief. So degree of belief includes long-range relative frequencies when that seems appropriate, but it may also include probabilities for things where there are no frequencies. It happens only once. So the basic concept is that if we've observed data D, then we make predictions based on the conditional probabilities given D. So, for instance, if we've measured the random variable X, we got the value 0, and we're interested in predicting whether some event A happens or has happened, or whether A is true or false, then we predict whether A is true or whether it happens by the conditional probability of A given X equals 0, because X equals 0 is what we've observed. And if we have various scientific theories that I'll number as T1, T2, and so forth, we judge their plausibility by the probability of that theory given the data. And things are a little bit complicated here because, of course, we may not have a fixed set of possible theories. You can always imagine more theories. So rather than talk about the actual probability of theory one, which would depend on whether there are only theories one and two, or whether there's also another theory three, or another theory four, and so forth, which is a little bit indefinite, we can less ambitiously look at the ratio of probabilities for two particular theories, which might be less dependent on whether there are yet more theories that might be invented. Now, the crucial thing here is that when we evaluate the probabilities of theories, we have to do the conditional probabilities conditioning on all the evidence. You don't get to pick and choose. like if somebody is doing a clinical trial of a drug and they tried it out on 1,000 patients, well, you have to assess the probability the drug works based on all 1,000 patients. You don't get to say, well, these 20 where it didn't work, we'll discard them, and these ones here, well, we don't like them, we'll take a subset, and oh, we conclude the drug works, right? But you have to take all the data. It's cheating to not look at some of the data, at least all the relevant data. Of course, in a clinical trial of a drug, you don't have to condition on what your grandmother's birthday is. It's not usually relevant. But if you have any doubts, then you include your grandmother's birthday if you're not sure it's irrelevant. If it's really irrelevant and you do the computations correctly, it'll just come out as making no difference. So if we're not sure what's relevant, D should just be everything we know. Okay, now the actual mechanics of how we do this is typically by applying Bayes' rule, because our sort of background knowledge typically tells us something about the probability of the data given a theory or given something else, so we can write that as probability of D given A is something that we may know. And we may also have what are called prior probabilities, probability of A, not conditioned on D, that represents what we knew before we got this particular data. And then using that, we can flip things around to get the probability of A given D, which I'm assuming is what we're actually interested in. In terms of ratios of probabilities for theories, that can be written as what's called an odds ratio here, the ratio of probability for T1 given D to the probability of T2 given D, which is the ratio of their prior probabilities, PT1 over PT2, times what's called the ratio of likelihoods, PD given T1 and PD given T2. Likelihood is a technical statistical term which refers specifically to that probability of the data given something you're trying to infer. So that's how you would evaluate the relative probabilities of T1 and T2. If you wanted to make a prediction that, while assuming some theory is true, maybe for no particular reason, or maybe because you actually have strong reason to think it's true, then we do that by predicting, by finding the probability of some event A that we're interested in, given the data and given that TI is true. I'm doing intersection here for and on the theory that I set them all up as sets, so intersection and are the same thing. People often also write commas instead of that. And so if you are interested in that, sort of assuming some theory is true, then you do Bayes' rule, but with the particular theory as something that you're also conditioning along all the way. Okay, so now I'm going to do a first of several quotes from the literature here to try to see what cosmologists are thinking here and how their thoughts relate to what I might think was the right way to use probability and Bayesian inference. And this is one of many sort of quotes I could have found expresses a simple sort of form of anthropic reasoning, and in this case seems to be saying that it's uncontroversial. Now, I wouldn't agree with that, the uncontroversial part. So here the quote says that we shouldn't be worried by the fact that the Earth is located at just the right point, distance from the sun, for life to evolve, because, well, if it hadn't been there, we wouldn't be here to see it. And so there's therefore no point in trying to explain why the Earth is 93 million miles from the sun. That's a fool's errand to try to explain that. And I think that's not correct. I think if anybody actually had a plausible theory of solar system formation that said that there's a strong probability that a solar system forming around a star like the sun will have a terrestrial-style planet somewhere between 90 and 95 million miles from the star, that there is a good reason for why the dynamics of the formation of the solar system would lead to that, that would be a better explanation for why the Earth is 93 million miles from the sun. In some sense, now, I think that's probably a fool's errand to look for such an explanation, but it's a fool's errand just because It doesn't seem that anybody has any plausible ideas as to why solar system formation would work that way. It's not that it's a fool's errand just because it would be not a interesting theory if you were to find one, right? This is, I think, an example of a common sort of thing that people do all the time in ordinary life, too, which is having decided something is true, which in this case is that there's no particular reason why the Earth is 93 million miles from the sun, you then start to think of more reasons why it's true, including some more reasons that maybe are not actually valid. So essentially, you're trying to make yourself feel more comfortable with it. You've already decided it's true, perhaps for very good reason, but you'd like to be even more comfortable with it being true, and so you may come up with extra reasons for it to be true that aren't actually correct. Another reason why one can get away with this here is that we're not talking about a very large factor in this particular example. If a theory that said that there had to be a planet 90 to 95 million miles from the sun would be, you know, at most a factor of 10 or something, better supported by the one observation we have. And so, a factor of 10 is no big deal here, because probably people differ by more than that in just their assessment of how plausible the theory is to start with. But I'd like to use this as an example of anthropic reasoning and what the arguments are put forth to say that is the right way to reason, and what arguments there are why it's not, and in particular, a principle that I'd like to put forward as being the correct principle, at least in small universes, where it's unlikely that you have a duplicate. And, well, I'll get to larger universes later. So the basis of this sort of claim, at least according to some philosophers and such who've tried to formalize it, is what's sometimes called the self-sampling assumption, that you should imagine that you're a randomly selected observer chosen uniformly from amongst all observers in some reference class. And that at all times and places and such. So that's the basis for saying that, we don't worry about the coincidence of the Earth being just the right distance from the sun because, we sort of got randomly put down in a solar system where there is a planet at the right distance, and so it's no surprise we're there. Like, if we randomly were put down if we randomly became some observer on some planet somewhere, of course it had to be a planet that was the right distance from its star to support life. And now, my contention would be that that's not the right way of reasoning, that we ought to evaluate theories by finding their conditional probabilities given all our data, which is all our memories and such, if we're not sure that some of those are irrelevant. And so now we're asking, which of these two theories, write these as T1 is the planet anywhere theory, and T2 is planet 90 to 95 million miles away theory. So we'll assume there's a planet somewhere, just to simplify things. And now the question is, if D is all our data, which includes the fact that we exist, which of these two theories is more likely? Well, we take the ratio of prior probabilities. So this is where, in practice, this falls apart in that nobody has a plausible reason why the planet should be exactly that distance. So, in fact, the probability for T2 a priori here, based on general plausibility, is very low. So, in fact, we're going to get only like a factor of 10 after that. And so the end conclusion is correct that there's no that T1 is true, but it's just because we don't have a plausible T2. But if we assume we did, somebody came up with a really clever idea as to how really some particular effect in solar system formation had previously been ignored as being unimportant, but really it's not unimportant. And when you account for that, it turns out that the really planets tend to be between 90 and 95 million miles away, so that now we thought that these were at least equally, T2 is at least equally plausible. At this point, we have some experimental data about this. Let's suppose we don't have that yet. So we're just basing it on, you know, simulations, computer simulations of solar system formation. And of course, they always ignore a few effects. And somebody discovers that if you don't ignore this effect that was thought to be negligible, you end up with a T2 like this. And but of course, maybe there's other effects. It's not that we're sure T2 is right. But anyway, we suppose that for some reason we've gotten our prior probabilities almost the same. And then we have to do the ratio of probability of the data for the two. And when you think about it a lot, you get various complications here, which I don't think actually affect the result. Ignoring those, just reasoning a bit naively, you'd say that the probability of you, somebody with all your memories, is higher if planets generally form at the right distance from their star to produce life than if they don't have any tendency to do that. Yeah. We want it the other way around. Yeah. It's not on the slide. It's not on this slide. Yep. Okay. So if planets have a tendency to form in just the right place, then it's more likely that somewhere in the universe you will exist. Because, of course, it's unlikely in a small universe, it's unlikely that you exist at all. That is, you with all the memories you actually have. But it gets more likely if there's more chances, more planets where you might have where you might have evolved and ended up with exactly your memories. So these factors are, each of these is extremely tiny, but the ratio should be in favor of T2, right? If there's no tendency for planets to form in the right place, you'd expect it's less likely than if there is a tendency for planets to form in the right place. So that's my explanation as to why you should favor T2, assuming it wasn't unlikely a priori. And I call that principle full non-indexical conditioning, although I've wondered whether I ought to change the name, partly because it seems cosmologists use the word conditioning in the opposite of the sense that I use it, which I'll get to in a moment. It's non-indexical because the data here is just the data that someone exists with your memories. You can imagine there's additional data, which is that you have your memories, where you is sort of like you can't define you in terms of, or me in terms of objective properties like what memories I have and such. Instead, it's some mysterious thing where you assume that there's some sort of essence of a person. And even though two people have identical memories, they're still different people because they have different essences or something. And we're not going to consider any such essences as part of the data. If you do, then you might say, well, it doesn't matter how many solar systems there are with planets in the right place. If people evolved there, they wouldn't have the right essences to be me, and so maybe they don't count. Now, an alternative way of getting this is to assume something else called the self-indication assumption, which is assumed by some people, like, for instance, Ken Olam seems to favor this both SSA and SIA. And SIA says the probability of a theory should be adjusted in proportion to the number of observers that in the reference class that it predicts are going to exist. So it predicts that theories that say there are going to be more observers should be preferred to theories that say there are only few observers. And then, of course, you immediately decide that T2 is favored, other things being equal, because it predicts a lot more observers around all these extra planets at the right distance. It's at the bottom here. One can figure out is that actually SIA plus SSA gives the same result as FNC. But a difference here is that that my assumption is how you should go do things by just simply finding conditional probabilities based on all the data you have doesn't have any sort of arbitrary reference class involved. And it also has a clear justification as being the standard method of Bayesian statistical inference, that you just find conditional probabilities conditional on all your data. Essentially, if you assume SIA plus SSA, you've introduced a reference class that just cancels out in the end. And maybe it's worth going over that. So here, the reason why T2 gets favored with SSA plus SIA is first of all, we'll assume that our ordinary prior ratio of prior probabilities is 1, say, so we don't have any original reasons to favor T1 over T2 or vice versa. But now the SIA principle says we should alter that because T2 predicts more observers than T1. So let's say that T1 predicts H humans, and let's say humans is our reference class, and T2 predicts 10H humans. So now we alter our prior probability ratio of 1 to instead be a factor of 10 in favor of T2. Yeah. You should think of it as that it's both theories say that there's the same number of stars, and for that matter, the same number of planets. The theories differ only in where the planet turns out to be. Theory T2 says it preferentially turns out to be just the right place for life for reasons having nothing to do with life, just the dynamics of solar system formation, whereas T1 says there's no particular tendency for it to turn out to be at just the right distance. It could just by chance, but it has no particular tendency. Yeah, it's large, but not so large that you'd expect there to be duplicate observers. Yeah. Right, yeah. Yep. Even T1 will predict some Earth-like planets and observers. T1 won't predict zero observers, yeah. T1 predicts H humans, where H is reasonably big. So T2 predicts 10 times that many, and according to the SIA principle, you should then alter this factor to favor T2 by a factor of 10. Now, what's the probability of the data given T1 or the data given T2? Well, if you accept SSA, the self-sampling assumption, this ratio would be equal to 1 because you sort of imagine with SSA that you start out as a disembodied soul, but then you're randomly placed down in some observer. And, well, since we assume that H is at least 1, so there's an observer for you to get into. We won't worry about your soul can't find anybody. And so the data is equally likely for those two. And so the end result is that SSA plus SIA implies T1 is only a tenth as likely as T2. Whereas just SSA with no SIA says that it's equal to 1 because it has no adjustment of this based on SIA. That's an interesting point, which I'll get to. So at the moment, I've assumed that our universe is small, right? And also here, I'm assuming that these two theories differ only in the density of Earth-like planets. They don't just differ in how big the universe is. And so that's what I'm confining myself to at the moment. And you should be, because that's an issue. But for the moment, just assume that these theories don't differ in how big the universe is, and the universe is small enough there's no duplicates. All we're talking about here is essentially the density of observers changing from one to the other. Okay. Mm-hmm. If there are. Oh, it may. I'm getting to that later here, right? For the moment, we want to assume there are no duplicates. So. If it's negligible, that's still okay. As long as it's negligible, that's good enough here. You mean if there's some deep philosophical question about what you're supposed to do when there's a duplicate of you? Well, I'm assuming, I'll actually get to this as the general principle, that I'm assuming that if you have a small universe where the chance of a duplicate of you is 10 to the minus 1,000, that really that shouldn't affect how you do your calculations. But anyway, for the moment, the universe is small. We're comparing theories that don't differ in the size of the universe, only in the density of observers. And we're seeing what happens in that case. So this is what we get by assuming SIA with a reference class of humans. Now, well, the data here is the event that someone with your memories exists, and of course, if you found a partition of the whole set of possibilities in which that was one element of the partition, then you ought to sum to one over that partition. But there's no obvious, you don't have to figure out such a partition here. You have the event D is somebody with your memories exists in the universe. There's no particular reason to partition the rest of the possibilities up in some way. Okay, so now let's suppose that we don't like the reference class of humans. That's a bit parochial. There could be inhabitants of Jupiter too, right? And suppose that both theories predict inhabitants of Jupiter, for that matter, but the same number Jupiteronians or whatever they are, they predict the same number. Right? And now we change our reference class to be the reference class of both humans and inhabitants of Jupiter. Well, what happens? Well, from the point of view of my method of asking what's the probability that someone with exactly your memories exists, this is completely irrelevant. You're not living on Jupiter. The fact that the theories both predict that somebody else lives on Jupiter has no effect on the probability of D under these theories, so everything's just exactly the same. If you look at SSA plus SIA, however, it might seem that everything changes because you've changed the reference class. But what happens here is now in the number of beings in the reference class under T1 is H plus J. Under T2, it's 10H plus J. So now the factor here used to be H over 10H, 1/10. It's now H plus J over 10H plus J, which, of course, is with J non-zero, is not 1 over 10. So it seems like changing the reference class has changed what your conclusions are from SIA assumption that the theories are likely in proportion to how many observers they produce. So it seems like we're not going to get a different answer. But no, we don't, because we're also assuming the self-sampling assumption. If our reference class now includes beings on Jupiter, then we have to downgrade the probability of data given T1, which used to be 1. This ratio of probabilities was 1. Now, you have to now take account of the probability that you're actually a human, according to SSA. And well, the probability that you're human if you're under theory T1 is, this is the old version of SSA plus SIA. This is the new version. In the new version, the probability that you're human is is 10H over 10H plus J. Right, which when we flip around this ratio gets us it the other way around. And you multiply them together and this cancels out. And 10H. let's see, what did we have here? We have here we used to have one. Now this is now it's H divided by H plus J for theory T1, and it's 10H divided by 10H plus J for theory T2. This cancels with this. This cancels with that, and we get the same answer as before. So that's what I think is the right answer. So you could say that I should be happy with SSA plus SIA. But it seems a rather baroque way of getting the correct answer. You first of all introduce a reference class for which the choice of reference class actually makes no difference. And then you compute modified prior probabilities, which do depend on the reference class. But the dependence on the reference class all cancels out when you do the rest of the calculation. So if you accept the results of SSA plus SIA, I say that you can get those results a lot more simply by just making the standard assumption in statistical inference that you should assess theories based on the conditional probability given all the data. And you don't have to introduce a reference class of some sort or other, which appears rather completely arbitrary, because it all, you just look at the probability of getting your particular memories. And in general, things about the theory that clearly don't affect whether somebody with your memories exists are irrelevant. So for instance, if we had these same two theories, but now for some reason the sun was an exception here. So in fact, theory T2 said that, well, most stars have planets that are in that range because of the dynamics of solar system formation. But it doesn't happen if you have a large planet like Jupiter. And then it's just random. Well, in that case, you wouldn't find that you had any preference for T2 over T1, because we actually are in a solar system with a large planet like Jupiter. The fact that T2 predicts many more lifelike planets elsewhere in other star systems is irrelevant if it doesn't increase the probability of one in our solar system, because we are in our solar system. We remember seeing Jupiter. And so T2 doesn't change the probability of someone with your memories existing if it only applies to solar systems that don't have Jupiter-sized planets. And so you would come to the conclusion that our existence on Earth doesn't really tell you anything about the relative probability of T1 and T2. And now if you think about it deeply enough, you'll figure out that SSA plus SIA, if you apply it sufficiently correctly, comes to the same conclusion, but because of a bizarre cancellation from SSA. No, I've assumed that the universe is small. So it's unlikely that there's a duplicate of you somewhere with exactly your memories, which, assuming that the universe is fairly independent from one place to another, means that it wasn't especially likely that you existed either. Both of these probabilities are small, but this one is 10 times that one, because there's sort of 10 times more chances for you to someone with your memories to come into being when there's 10 times as many. Okay, so another couple quotes here. One from Anthony Aguirre, or however it's pronounced, about the dangers of what seems to be called top-down reasoning, in which you make successive predictions and then sort of say, well, the things are just like they are, as from the previous observations, and now I'll make a prediction and see whether or not this disconfirms some theory. But having made it, well, that's just the way it is. And I think Anthony doesn't favor this. But it seems other people may favor this sort of approach to things. So Stephen Hawking here is arguing that you don't have to try to explain why the universe is four-dimensional, that that's, for some reason, a piece of information that you should ignore when evaluating your theories. And so the question is, when should we ignore information? And you can think of anthropic reasoning as essentially saying you should ignore the information about how many observers in the reference class exist when evaluating how plausible a theory is, at least if you assume that all the theories predict at least one observer. I won't worry about the case where one might predict no observers. Now, one problem with this, of course, is that the answer may vary depending on the reference class, because depending on your reference class, you're ignoring more or less information. And the choice of reference class seems completely arbitrary, so this doesn't seem like a very very satisfying principle of inference. But we see that there's an even more extreme view, which is you should simply ignore all information when evaluating how plausible a theory is. So I'm not clear how you arrive at that. But one possible source of confusion is that when we are looking at the probability of a theory, PTI given D, well, The experimental term in that is PD given TI. And of course, if D is actually the conjunction of a bunch of events, the results of a bunch of experiments, and these are independent given TI, then PD given TI is just the product of the probabilities of each of the individual experimental results. And if we view the probability in that way as the product of probabilities for successive things we did, then when we come to predicting one of those, of course, it doesn't matter what happened on the previous one. If we assume TI is true, the prediction for DK doesn't depend on whether the previous predictions turned out very well or not. You might say, when predicting the next flip of a coin, it doesn't matter whether you got 100 heads just before that, which is very unlikely, as long as you're convinced that the coin is fair. But when you assess the total evidence for TI, of course, you don't do that. You do that based on the probability of D given TI, which is the product of all of those. The fact that you happen to have observed some in the past doesn't mean you get to ignore that information. I'm not too clear why that's not obvious. Maybe I'm missing something about the arguments there. So now some quotes from Lenny here, which I'm not sure whether these represent current opinions or not, which are relevant to the question of how you should evaluate theories when the theories have unknown parameters. So here these theories don't have any unknown parameters, at least we pretended they don't. But now suppose that the theories do have unknown parameters. And so at the bottom here, we see one example like that, where there is the proposal that perhaps condensed matter physics sort of theories might be a good theory of cosmology. And a property of those is that they don't have very many free parameters, so that you can't manage to get all sorts of different results by just varying things. Only a few results are possible, but nobody's worked out what they are. Now, of course, possibly the whole theory is basically flawed altogether, in which case that would be accounted for by just having a small prior probability. But supposing that's not the case, we could ask, how do we evaluate this theory in which we expect that there's very little wiggle room in this theory, but we haven't actually worked out what the result is yet, so we can't test it against data yet. But we expect that once we've worked it out, we will get a very specific prediction. Of course, we don't know whether that prediction will be right yet or not. So we can look at how we should assess evidence for theories with free parameters like that. And if a theory T1 has some free parameter, I'll assume just one for simplicity, for which we have some prior density, F, based on some sort of plausibility arguments, mathematical, or based on previous evidence, then the way we figure out the probability of the data given T1 is to integrate the probability of the data given T1 and a particular value X for the parameter with respect to that density for X. So you can see then that if the density for X is the density for phi is very broad, then the theory doesn't make very specific predictions because we have to integrate everything over that broad density F. And so the probability for particular data sets would be lower than if we had a density F that was concentrated around values that actually do predict the actual data. Of course, that would mean that it would give low probability to other data sets. Now, if D is all our memories, then in a small multiverse, the entire multiverse is still small enough that you're unlikely to have a duplicate, then if the multiverse has no free parameters, we suppose, but the universes in the multiverse get randomly created with different values of phi with the same density F, then we get a similar sort of expression there, except there's something here about how many universes there are in the multiverse, which you could imagine that our other theory, T1, we can just, by an ad hoc device, just say, well, it doesn't predict just one universe. It predicts a whole bunch of them for no particular reason. But, well, if there can be one for no particular reason, why not a billion for no particular reason? So, they all have the same free parameter phi in T1. And so we could equalize the number of the volume if we want. And T1 and T2 differ in that in T1, all the universes have some particular value of phi, the same value in all universes, but we don't know what that value is. Whereas in T2, every universe has a different value of phi, and there are no free parameters in T2. The density F is part of T2, fixed theoretically. Whereas in T1, the density F is just our guess as to what phi might be. Eventually, we may hope to figure out what phi is for T1. So we can then consider also a model T3, which is sort of like the condensed matter physics style models from the previous slide, in which phi is fixed, say that just has just one, has a single value, but we haven't managed to compute what that value is. So, and now our best guess as to what it is given by the density F. Now, with a bigger computer, we will actually be able to figure out what phi is, but we haven't yet, what phi is in model T3. And now, so for that T3 where we haven't figured out what phi is yet, we'd also have to say that the probability of the data would be calculated by that integral with respect to F. But now, once we manage to actually compute the phi zero that is actually the one determined by T3, then the probability of T3 is going to either go down to something very low or to something very high, depending on whether or not that particular value of phi 3 turns out to be one that explains the data well. Well, could be just by total coincidence that it happens to be somewhere in between there and ends up not changing the probability of the data, but probably very likely it will. And so after we've actually figured out what phi naught is, then we'll be able to say whether T3 is now very likely or not very likely at all. So to go back to the quote here, this seems to be describing a situation like a theory T3 with a unique value for the parameter, but we haven't computed what it is yet. And saying that because we haven't computed what it is yet, it seems rather unlikely that it's going to turn out to be the right value. And I'd say that you might believe that, and it might be coherent to believe that, but if that's so, then what you really believe is the prior probability of the whole theory is very low. You just don't believe the theory. You don't believe the theory is true. If you believe the theory is true, or thought it was plausible that it was true, then you have to believe that that once you figure out the value phi naught, that's the actual value implied by the theory, but is difficult to compute, then it'll actually match the experimental data. That's what it means to think that T3 might be true. You know, if you think T3 has a probability half of being true, then you have to think that if you figured out phi naught, there's a probability half that it would actually match the experimental data. So this seems to me. Well, you haven't figured out phi naught yet, right? So you don't know whether this theory matches the data yet or not. You have some general ideas based on mathematical plausibility or whatever as to whether this T3 is plausible or not. But you haven't been able to figure out, you haven't been able to do the calculation to find phi naught. Once you have phi naught, we assume you can check it against the data and see whether it explains the data well. But you haven't managed to compute it yet. Right? And so, yeah, I'm saying you shouldn't do that. Your prior for phi, it's a bit of a funny prior. It gets into the question of how you should rationally reason when your reasoning is constrained by computational constraints. But trying to just sort of skate over that, since you haven't been able to compute the phi naught implied by the theory yet, you just have some vague guess as to what phi naught might be based on some mathematical approximations or something that maybe give you some sort of hint as to what phi naught might be. And that's the basic, but it's broad, so you don't have any clear idea what phi naught is going to turn out when you actually do the computations. And so you can't just say that, well, then I believe it's going to turn out to be the phi naught that fits the data. You can't do that. What I'm saying is that to say that because there's a huge number of possible phis, but this theory only can explain one particular phi naught, and therefore you don't believe the theory, is equivalent to just saying that you don't believe the theory just on a priori grounds, there are plenty of theories in which, you know, actual theories that do become accepted theories in which initially you haven't computed things, and when you and there's a wide range of things that conceivably could result from that computation. So you could think of quantum theory back in 1920 or whatever, and at that point you might say, well, quantum theory ought to explain atomic spectra, but surely it's totally unlikely that when we do the calculations we'll actually manage to match the experimental data. One wouldn't consider that to be a very reasonable thing to say. If you think quantum theory might be the right theory, then you would expect that when you do the calculations, it will match the experimental data, right? And so you shouldn't downgrade your assessment of plausibility of the theory on the grounds that you haven't yet worked out the consequences. If you do, there's all sorts of possibilities, and surely it's unlikely they'd match the data. That's not a logic that people used in the past. Okay, so. Okay, so what about the large infinite universes or multiverses and so forth? Then, there's a problem here with this approach. If the universe is large enough to have duplicate observers, then the probability of some being with your memories existing may approach 1, and it'll be equal to 1 for some suitable infinite universe, and then we can't compare theories based on PD given TI because they all just say it's 1, so we always just get ratios of 1. So that's a problem, and I'm not sure of the solution to that problem. Or maybe that problem actually indicates that the whole approach has to be abandoned. But a conservative approach here would be to assume that once all the difficulties arising with such large universes are actually resolved, that the result is going to be much the same as for a small universe, which is that you don't have to do any anthropic reasoning. That seems debatable in a cosmological context. Maybe you think that those difficulties are the whole crux of the matter, and that there's no reason to think that that things will be similar to a small universe once you've accounted for all of that. But I think it's at least reasonable if you're tempted to apply anthropic reasoning to non-cosmological problems, such as, well, this isn't really a cosmological problem here about whether planets form at a particular distance from a star or not. Because to apply anthropic reasoning in this sort of context, you're implicitly making some sort of assumption about how big the universe is. This would be my way, I claim, is the right way to reason if the universe is small enough to not have duplicate observers. It seems strange that you're reasoning about this sort of relatively mundane problem should be sensitive to that question about exactly whether the universe is huge or really, really, really huge. Should that really matter? As I say, I'm not sure quite what one should be doing in these large and infinite universes. But one thing I think you have to be careful about is making these fantastic assumptions, fantastic as in very far from our ordinary understanding of ordinary life and such, and then not actually taking it seriously. So this arises in other philosophical puzzles and such where people say, well, suppose blah, which is actually very fantastic, and then they reason through things, assuming things that aren't true if you make that fantastic assumption, but which, you know, you don't immediately see aren't true after that fantastic assumption. Once you're assuming something very bizarre, then all sorts of other things may not be true. So this gets us into Boltzmann brains here. One question I have about these Boltzmann brains is what people think the actual argument is here. So here's one example of the sort of argument saying that, of course, no one really believes he is a Boltzmann brain. So the argument here could be that, well, we have some cosmological theory, and it predicts there'll be enormously more Boltzmann brains than ordinary observers. If we now apply this self-sampling assumption, we sort of are a disembodied soul who gets put in the universe in a randomly selected brain, then we're very likely to become a Boltzmann brain. But we're not a Boltzmann brain, so that theory's wrong. It's crucial there that you believe you're not a Boltzmann brain. Why should you believe that? Well, here's a proposed simple test. You just, having thought of this question, you wait 1 second, and if you still exist, then you aren't a Boltzmann brain, because, with very high probability, because Boltzmann brains are momentary fluctuations, and it's likely you'll just explode within a second or two. I think something similar is here. We'll stick with that for the moment. And now, unfortunately, I think this doesn't work. The whole problem is that if you accept this Boltzmann brain idea, then you accept SSA, then you'd say that even with we'll do SSA with a very narrow reference class of people with exactly your memories, then the argument is that a randomly selected observer with exactly your memories is more likely to be a Boltzmann brain than an ordinary observer. But that stays true for observers who remember having done this test. If you're doing this test, it's presumably not obvious to you that you're a Boltzmann brain. You seem to have memories of childhood and all those other things that would indicate you're not a Boltzmann brain. But if you can get an observer with those memories of childhood and so forth as a Boltzmann brain, then you can just equally well get an observer with memories of having done this experiment as a Boltzmann brain. You can't solve the Boltzmann brain issue by a little experiment like that, I think. No, we're doing just SSA here if we're trying to discard a theory on the basis that it has an infinite number of Boltzmann brains, let's make it not infinite for that matter, if just a huge number. If you were doing SIA, you'd say, well, it's favored by the fact that there's all this huge number of Boltzmann brains, at least if your reference class includes Boltzmann brains. So let's forget about SIA, but that's for the question of whether you are a Boltzmann brain, given that you're accepting this cosmological theory, so there's only one theory, we're not going to compare theories, you're just interested in whether you're a Boltzmann brain or not, I'm saying you can't resolve the question this way, because a Boltzmann brain who remembers having done this experiment is just as likely as the other Boltzmann brain. Not true? Condition on? Well, this gets into exactly what you think you should do with SSA, I guess. Having done the experiment, there's still an infinite number more Boltzmann brains who think they've done, well, huge, sufficiently huge, right? But it's assumed here that you have an apparently long coherent memory. If you can examine your memories and see all sorts of drastic inconsistencies and such, then you already know you're not a Boltzmann brain. And I would say that if you're applying FNC, despite the fact it's a little bit beyond the range that I've sort of argued it's valid in, then you would immediately say that you'd say that the existence of such brains that can tell they're not Boltzmann, that are aware of being Boltzmann brains, is irrelevant to the probability that you exist, where you apparently are not a Boltzmann brain. So other people seem to have similarly not been clear on as to exactly what the Boltzmann brain problem is. So if Boltzmann brains prevail here at, say, we'd be surrounded by an empty world rather than the rich structure that we observe. Well, I would say that that's not necessarily true for a Boltzmann brain, of course, but if you think it is, that the Boltzmann brains can see an empty world, then obviously we're not a Boltzmann brain, and the existence of Boltzmann brains has no effect on the probability of us existing under that theory, because we don't see an empty world. So I think, stop at that point.
So let's take just a few questions from Boltzmann brains first. Don?
I think I disagree with some of your assumptions. I think would think a much better way to do it would be to formulate a set of possible observations. You could say they're human, whatever you want. I personally tend to prefer to say conscious perceptions. But you have a set. Let's, for simplicity, assume it's a discrete countable set. Then, for each theory, you want a normalizable probability on that. In other words, you just want the probability for the possible observations. I don't want to include any probability that there's no observation at all. I mean, that any theory that has absolutely no observation is just ruled out at the very beginning. So only consider theories that really do have observations, but they have different, with different measures you can interpret as probabilities. Then if you say if the theory then gives you the normalizable probability of the observation, then you just use that as the likelihood for the theory and then multiply by the priors to get the thing. And that all seems to be very consistent, and it, I think, gives different answers from your assumption, because you're assuming sets of data of which some of the elements of the set include no observation at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're basically arguing for SSA, which is to say, basically arguing that you get life for free. So your theory that says that there is a huge number of universes, many of which have no life, but there are at least a few universes with life in them, then you're comparing that with a theory that says there's the same number of universes and all of them have life, right?
I'm conditioning on observations, and let's say it includes conscious perception. So I'm conditioning only. I'm assuming the universe does have a conscious perception, at least one, and I'm just, so I'm just conditionally. My reference class is all conscious perceptions.
So I'm assuming both theories say that there is at least one observer.
Yeah.
But one says there are oodles of observers in all sorts of universes. The other says there's only a few universes with a few observers. And so the question is, are you sort of not penalizing the theory that has few observers for having many fewer than the other one? At least if both theories are still small enough that that there aren't any duplicate observers, then I'm arguing that the one with more observers has a higher probability of producing your actual memories than the one with few observers. Even though they both do have some observer of some sort, but the probability of an observer with exactly your memories is higher when there are more observers, at least of the right sort, that could have had your memories, put it that way. I'm not clear as to what normalizing the probability distribution has to do here. We could assume here, for the sake of argument, that these are sort of stochastic universes, classically stochastic or whatever, where the theory says that there's this random set of universes created according to some probability distribution, and the probability, that's a normalizable probability distribution, we assume, and so there's some chance that the universe created randomly in that way will have somebody with your memories, and some chance it won't, and the chance is higher when for the universe that for the theory that produces lots of universes with life than for the one that produces only a few universes with life.
Well, I think I'm saying that I expect a very simple theory to have very negligible probability of producing my observation. But if it's, a very simple theory that predicts only a small number of observations. Multiverse theory, I think, to me, we don't know the full thing, but the string M landscape sounds to me as rather an outsider for string theory to be very elegant. And it produces a huge number of observations, but I'm guessing that the number it predicts is much less than the number of possible observations, like Boltzmann brain. Let's assume we solve the Boltzmann brain problem in a traditional way, that there aren't very few of those, that most observations are rather ordered. That's a very tiny set out of all possible ones. There may be lots of ordered ones, so the probability is very small for each one, but that multiplied by the prior of the theory, I would think is much more higher than if I had a theory that predicted just my observation. That would have unit likelihood. That would be the maximum likelihood theory, a theory that predicts just my observation. I think such a theory would be so complicated that I would assign it an extremely tiny prior. So tiny that prior would be much smaller than the prior for string M theory, multiplied by the admittedly very small probability for my observation compared to all the others.
Yeah, I'm assuming that we're comparing two theories that are otherwise plausible theories, and that we would assign roughly equal prior probabilities to based on usual considerations of elegance and so forth. And so a theory that says that for no particular reason somebody just like you exists is not a very plausible theory, and so that would have a very low prior probability. That's nothing unique to cosmology here. In general, for any sort of application of these things, the theory that says the distribution of data is just exactly the data set you got for no reason has to be given a very small prior probability that cancels out the fact that it predicts the data perfectly.
I don't know about the Boltzmann brains, but I think the ordinary observers need coffee. But before we get coffee, Neil, do you want to make an announcement? Did you want to make an announcement?
I just want to encourage people to be around for the end of Tom's talk, even if you aren't for the beginning of Tom's talk, because we want to thank the staff. So thanks a lot. That'll be at the end. Okay.